I'm Mike Duran, and welcome back to Counterbalance. Unfortunately, Marshall couldn't be here this week, so I'm flying solo, and I have with me Ed Hussein. Ed has joined us before. Ed is a prominent British intellectual, very prominent in Muslim affairs in Britain. He's also a political advisor, a Middle East expert. For years, he advised Tony Blair about the Middle East and Muslim affairs. He has just written a very interesting book about mosques in Britain. The book's about Muslim, non-Muslim relations in Britain. Ed is very concerned about where things are going. We only scratched the surface in this conversation. You know, I could talk to Ed for hours, and I hope to have him back soon to talk more about the book and his whatever his next project is. Yeah, without further ado, thanks for joining us. We're just going to dive right in. Ed Hussein, welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Duran. It's a real pleasure to be here with you.
Yeah, I'm glad you're... Are you not Dr. You are Dr. Hussein, aren't you?
I am 5 days away from my Viva, so I'm almost there.
Are you going to do it... Because you're here in the United States. Are you going to do your Viva electronically?
Yes, I'd have to do the Viva electronically even in the UK because...
And the
external examiner is not in London. So yeah, all kind of complications, but that's where we are. But thank you.
Okay, well, congratulations on your PhD.
Thank you.
So we're here to talk about your third book, Among the Mosques, which is a very, very revealing book. I learned a lot from it. Before we actually talk about the book, let me just describe what it is for the listeners.
But before you do that, can I just say thank you, Mike, for reviewing it in the Wall Street Journal and getting to the nub of the issue. So I'm grateful to you for bringing it to an American audience's attention.
Thank you for writing it. It was really, it does what a book should do. It takes you into places you're never going to go on your own. I'm never going to walk into a British mosque and start talking to people. I mean, I might, but it will be on a very superficial level. And you really took us to areas we can't go alone.
But that's the problem, Mike, because you have done and can do that in Turkey, in Egypt, in the United Arab Emirates, and other countries. You can freely walk in as you've done. But why can't we do that in the West, especially in England? And therein lies the problem. Sorry to interrupt you. You were going to do a synopsis, I think.
Yeah, actually, why don't you do the synopsis since it's your book? Tell us the thumbnail sketch.
It was exactly what you've just said. Why is it that a population of about 4% of, on the higher end, say 7% of the British British population, can build mosques that are physically resembling villages in Pakistan and India, but also cutting themselves physically off from large sections of their own neighborhoods? And Ibn Khaldun, the great Muslim sociologist, always wrote about belonging. How do you belong to a land? Because he was dealing with Bedouins and nomads as well as settled people. And it just struck me that large numbers of Muslim communities across the West, but particularly in England, did not belong. And others saw them as outsiders and treated them as outsiders. And we're not going to get to that tension between belonging and not belonging unless we go to the most physical, the most obvious, the most visible and loud symbol of Muslims. It's the buildings, it's the architecture, it's the mosques that now increasingly dominate almost 25 to 30 large towns and cities. So what's going on in there? And as you say, Mike, most people feel hesitant to walk in. And that matters, I'm afraid. I mean, you can't build constructions across the country where they're just shut off from other people, whether it's intentional or otherwise. So I went on a journey to try and understand what's going on in mosques, not with the hat of my being Muslim on, but also with the hat of my being a Brit and a Westerner. I've struggled over the years to marry those two identities. And I think I'm there now that I feel equally comfortable being a Westerner as I am a Muslim. And I wanted to bring both of those into mosques and see with a genuinely open Socratic spirit if Muslims are.
That's another thing that I thought was particularly interesting about the book. First of all, it took me to places that I was not going to go, but then also your personal position. You are a well-known critic of Islamism and a political Islam. But I don't know if you're unique, but you certainly stand out among those well-known authors who are critics of political Islam in that you are a believing Muslim. This is a field. The criticism of political Islam is full of. It's a field in which there aren't a lot of at least of the most prominent voices, a lot of believing Muslims, and that was really striking to me.
Especially in the English language, in the Muslim world, in Arabic, there are many, many, many critics of Islamism. In India, I find, you know, Hussein Ahmed Madani, who was the founder. I mean, let's not go into the details, but the point is he was a Muslim cleric who was opposed to Maududi, the founder of the Jamaat-e-Islami. So they exist. But sadly, this space in the West should also be occupied by many, many more Muslims who are believers and see their own faith tradition and their heritage and their history being hijacked by people who are essentially Marxists, who are using the Marxist paradigm of understanding history and understanding the role of the state and trying to control the government in order to redistribute power and wealth along Marxist models. The difference is the Marxists don't believe in God and the Islamists believe in God. And if I may, you see that nexus in Gaza, you see that nexus in Iran, and we're beginning to see that here with AOC and Ilhan Omar. We're seeing it in the UK between Jeremy Corbyn and his left-wing supporters. I mean, they say they're not Marxists, but I mean, I'm not interested in the kind of pedantics of whether you're a communist, Marxist, and social democrat, and all the rest of the nonsense. You're anti-West, you're anti-capitalist, you're anti-Israel, you're anti our allies across the world, and you want to undo our heritage and our history. That makes you Marxist.
And you want state control.
You want state control. Right. You're state-centric. That's what makes you Marxist. I don't really care about the particularities of whether it's which version of the international movements we're on, whether you're a Leninite or a Trotskyite. I mean, all that stuff is detailed for them to fight over because they're schismatic. We're interested in protecting our civilization and our heritage and our history. For us, you're a threat. You're a Marxist. It doesn't matter which color you are.
Schismatic is a nice word. but you actually meant prone to schism, didn't you?
Constantly.
Does schismatic mean, because I always think of schismatic when the communists are accusing some breakaway faction.
Well,
they say, you're a schismatic. Can the word also mean prone to schism?
By inference, obviously, yes. That's what they're like. I mean, they can never unite themselves because they're driven by abstract ideas and they're not driven by reality and nature.
Right. Yeah, that's true. So before we talk about some of the specific places you visited, can you just give us a kind of overview, which came out in the book, by the way, but an overview of the landscape, the religious, intellectual, political landscape? I mean, one of the things that I was only vaguely aware of, and I know much more now thanks to your book, is the distinction between the Barelvis and the Deobandis, and then we also have Salafis in there. And could you just discuss a little bit for our listeners, tell us what a Deobandi and a Barelvi is?
That's a great question, Mike, and it's very important. So just ask the listeners to bear with us for about 3 minutes as we do a quick tour of these three movements. The first movement, the Deobandi movement, is a genuine problem for the West because it was born as an anti-British movement in the 1850s.
Sorry to interrupt, because I realized just now when I asked the question why I think it's valuable to do this is because I think a lot of Americans now know what the Salafis are, and we have because we have since 9/11 we've gotten, as a society, much more informed about some of the trends in the Islamic world. But what's clear when you read your book is that the for obvious reasons, because of where the immigrants came from, it is really the Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi, the South Asian intellectual movements are the ones that are dominant in Britain. And I don't know that those are so well known here. So what we're so this is what you're giving us here is a little is an overview of the South Asian Islamic ferment as it's being experienced in Britain today.
That's shaping the country.
Yeah.
That's shaping the country in you know many, many good but some bad ways. And one of them is the separatism. But for American listeners, Salafis and an extreme version of them gave America 9/11. And it's worth just remembering that. It was the Salafi literalism. It was the Salafi rejection of the modern world. It was the Salafi justification of jihad against the West, all taken literally from scripture that gave, you know, the Saudi educational curriculum before it was recently reformed, the curse of 9/11 and everything that came after it. And tribute to you, Mike, for exposing Wahhabism and Salafism before and during a 9/11 and helping guide policymakers in your time in government and outside for identifying the Salafi trend. So that's what the Salafis are. In Britain, they're about 10% of the mosque population, but growing because you go into some of the younger population-run mosques and you see Salafis. But the Salafis are a real issue in Britain because they are operating on university campuses. And because they preach a very pure form of what appears as scripture to those who aren't specialists or don't have Arabic, they can have a real appeal. So those are the Salafis. The good news is Salafism is being chased out of the Middle East. You know, as we speak in Turkey, in Egypt, it wasn't really a problem in Turkey, but in Egypt it was a huge problem. In Saudi Arabia it used to be a massive problem. But they're clamping down on the literalism and opening young Muslim minds to a much more mystical, reason-oriented, love-based form of religiosity, and not just the anger, the literalism. So those are the Salafis. You also know, and your audience knows, the Deobandis because...
Taliban.
The Taliban, exactly, exactly. So I think, you know, our American cousins, friends, fellow citizens will have an appreciation of the Taliban from just... Their influences from the Deobandi movement. But I've got to be fair to the Deobandi movement and say that the Taliban, yes, they're an offshoot. And in Pakistan, the Taliban and the Deobandi movement are a problem. The Taliban just basically means students. Students of what? Students in Deobandi madrasas. So we never really go upstream. Yes, they're students, Taliban, plural. But of what? Of these Deobandi institutions, these madrasas, in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. But in India, interestingly enough, the mothership of the Deobandi movement that started off as an anti-British movement, in India, they've been co-opted by the state and the secular politicians. And now the Indian Deobandi movement is a lot more modernized, has open meetings with female politicians and a lot less literalist. And I think I take comfort and succor from the Deobandi movement because it supported in the 50s and the 40s, and earlier actually, Hussein Ahmed Madani, one of the main thinkers of the Deobandi movement in India, in the mothership, supported the creation of a secular state in India, opposed the creation of a separatist Pakistani Muslim state, and believed in love and loyalty to the nation and its secular laws. Now, if more Muslims embraced just that thesis, we would have a lot less problems in our life, because you know you'd embrace the world for what it is, and you wouldn't be opposed to Israel or to America or the West, because those are the ideas on which the West is based. So the Deobandi movement in India, I think, deserves credit. Now, sorry.
So the term Deobandi is a very elastic term. I mean, this is an intellectual, a religious movement that has gone in different directions in different places, and so we got to be careful in how we use it.
And draw on the Indian Deobandis to modernize and believe in the nation state, believe in secular laws and believe in individual freedom and move away from this Muslim supremacism that Muslims must dominate, be separatists and have our own countries. And that was the problem in the creation of Pakistan. And I'm sorry if this upsets people, but we've got to be true to the historical record, you know. The Deobandis, you know, to your earlier question, opposed Maududi and the Jamaat-e-Islami. And Deoband is the name of a place. It's a small institution somewhere, I think, 50 or so meters, miles outside Delhi today. So
so our listeners wouldn't have known the reference to Maududi. And I just want to make sure that I understood. You're saying that Maududi, who was a political, one of the founders of political Islam, that originally... the Dale Bundy movement opposed him and yes. rejected it, but then that, now that they have gone in that direction afterwards. Is that what you're saying?
No, it's more the guys in Pakistan and Afghanistan have become much more politicized and anti-West.
So they are sort of Maududiites even the,
In their politics now. Yes. But that's not where their founding fathers of the Dale Bundy movement in the, especially in the 1930s, when the debate around what happens if the British withdrew from India, how this would manifest. Now, it's all fascinating, Mike, because these were debates and conversations that were going on in India in the 1930s. And now we find ourselves having the same conversations in mosques in Britain in the 2020s. And how is it allowed that in Britain, you know, the most extreme Dale Bundis, i.e. the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistani Taliban types, are in control of the mosques. And therein lies 50, the real problem.
51 or 52%. Like you had a number in your book, about over half, I think you said.
Are leaning towards the Dale Bundi movement. Now, why should we in
And when
Britain,
you say that, you mean the Pakistani Dale Bundi movement? Right?
Yes. Why should we tolerate that? Why should we tolerate intolerance? We can easily say that you should be much more in line with the Indian secular, pietistic, individualistic form of Dale Bundi creed. We can live with that. It has challenges, but we can live with that. In a pluralistic society, we can. But we can't tolerate the misogyny and the homophobia that comes out of many of the Dale Bundi institutions today. Now, on the Brelvis, they're interesting because the Brelvis control almost the rest of the mosques, a good 40% or so of the mosques in Britain. And the Dale Bundis, the Brelvis are interesting because they emerged as a mystical, love-based movement. And
am I right in assuming that when you grew up, you were going to, your family was going to a Brelvi mosque?
Yes.
Because in the book, when you go into mosques and they're influenced by this mystic tradition, this clearly, obviously, speaks to you personally.
Yes, because in very personal things, on a very personal level, I think that's exactly what faith is. It's an individual relationship with God, based on loving God's creation, and trying to serve fellow human beings. And you do that through, whether it's prayer or love or music or food, or and the Brelvis do that.
They reject music.
They reject song. They abhor the female presence in mosques and so on. So there are all kinds of problems with modernity and the Dale Bundis, where the Brelvis, until very recently, were, I think, the allies of the West in confronting the Dale Bundi Taliban threat and the Salafi Al-Qaeda threat. But in the last 10 years or so, we've seen a real shift, even among the Brelvis. It's a strange world, Mike, because, you know, the Saudis are reforming. The Saudis are wanting to get rid of the Salafi beast, and they're trying to modernize. And the Dale Bundis in India are trying to modernize, and even in Pakistan, they realize it's a real problem. So just as we've got the Dale Bundi and the Salafi houses slightly in order, we have the sensible guys, the Brelvis, now going rogue on us. Mm. And by which I mean that the real problem with the Brelvis now is that on blasphemy laws and the cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, and from Salman Rushdie onwards, where they were not so vocal, now they've become vocal because of the issues in Pakistan, where the government in Pakistan has blasphemy laws and does not allow for insulting the Prophet Muhammad and does not allow for religious freedom. So now we're seeing that influence from Pakistan creep into Europe. So young Muslims who are raised in this tradition of loving the Prophet Muhammad, noble tradition, laudable, should be upheld, have taken that to an extreme. So I love the Prophet so much. If you insult the Prophet in any way, I'm going to kill you. It's literally as ugly as that, because there's a hadith in the Prophet, by hadith I mean narrations from the life of the Prophet, that apparently say someone insulted Muhammad and that individual was killed. Now, that's a debatable tradition. Nevertheless, that's now been embraced by large segments of the British Muslim population. And worse, because of the Charlie Hebdo, the cartoons in France, Muslims, activists have been forced to take a position. Are you in support of the cartoons or are you against the cartoons? Well, it's not so black and white. You can support the cartoons and say it's the freedom of the French people and the West in general as inheritors of the Greek tradition of comedy and tragedy. I mean, you can't run away from that freedom. But at the same time, dislike it, say it's bad art, bad aesthetics, and
also rude.
Rude.
To live together, you know, sure, live and let live. Sure. It's probably good if we don't go around insulting each other's religious traditions.
But that's France for you. Yeah. That's France for you. France, offends Jesus, Moses, every religious tradition under them. I mean, that's just being French, you know, and you just, you know, ask anyone who's Catholic in France what it's like being Catholics in 1789 when the French Revolution happened. You know, they Notre Dame became a temple of reason for the French, you know, an ancient cathedral. So my point is, you've got to understand the French for what they are. Yes, it's rude. Yes, I'm offended, but I'm not going to kill you for it. And that's where I think the Brelvers are a real problem increasingly, that they haven't. There's this concept of wajib qatl, the killing is obligatory if you are what they call gustakh rasul in Persian or Urdu, if you offend a prophet. That's a real challenge for freedom of speech across large parts of Europe now. And that's something we've got to confront and say, we don't agree with the cartoons, but we don't condemn them. Or in fact, actually, you can condemn them, but you don't have to kill the cartoonist. You know, art has got to be left as art, good art or bad art, without killing the artists.
So you went into all these different mosques, and you went to 10 different cities, and you went into the mosque, and you talked to people in the mosque, and you talked to people around the mosques, and so on. And you identified this growing literalism and clericalism, and I'm looking for a better word, separatism, communalism, which is disturbing you. So that there's an effort by political Islamists to wall off the Muslim community from the wider British society. And now you didn't you showed clear sympathy for the Barelvis, but also, as you just said, you're seeing this clericalism and literalism that we would have associated, you would have associated a few years ago with the Deobandis, also present in the Barelvis. Have I got that right?
Yes, absolutely right.
And so you're not really taking a Barelvi position against the Deobandis. Oh, that's where you come from, you want the Barelvi mysticism that you knew as a youngster. You'd like to see that preserved as it was, instead of being influenced by this clericalism, literalism, and communalism.
Yes, because that's that tradition that the Sufi love-based, individualized way of being Muslim, which is the majority of the world's Muslims, by the way. The Sufis are misunderstood in the West as being some kind of nice sect. They're not. I mean, whether you're Sunni or Shia, most Muslims have a very strong Sufi lineage or parts of Sufi orders. You know, just as Catholics have many orders, Muslims have many Sufi orders among them. So that tradition of being love-based is the only tradition that can work in the modern West. If you bring about a tradition, whether it's a Salafi or the Deobandi tradition, that says we've got to have our own laws and you must subjugate to this law over time, then what we lose is our own heritage, our own history as who we are in the West. And that's the real danger, and that's what I worry about. That if we don't hold on to our inheritance that allows for Muslims to be citizens as equal with everyone else, when we start compromising that and saying Muslim women have different laws.
When you say we in our heritage, you are talking about the British political heritage or the Sufi political heritage? You're speaking
as both, because in my mind, I've harmonized being a Westerner and a Muslim, and I want that harmony to remain. And I don't want my Muslim identity to be a supremacist, separatist, confrontational, subversive identity, which is where the Deobandis of the Pakistani or the Afghan variety take us. And that's the real danger, that we're not alert to this.
How many people would you think agree with you? Are you how many laudatory emails did you get from fellow Muslims saying, yes, I agree?
I woke up to the threat from the Brelvis, from Brelvi Muslims. Which is my reason for optimism, that they said our people, i.e. fellow Brelvis, are heading down this trajectory which will make us into criminals. In other words, you would start killing anyone who we disagree with. I mean, we ended all that centuries ago. So laudatory emails, yes, but I think more the fact that 30 million Muslims across the West have voted with their feet to be here. You know, they chose to be Western citizens or citizens of various Western countries by turning their backs on whether it's Pakistan or other countries. So I think that's the greatest vindication of continuing to harmonize and allowing citizens to be that, all citizens as equals under one secular law. The moment you start demanding Sharia law for women, Muslim women, to be separatist, not only is it sexist, I think it's ultimately self-destructive.
Right. Right. Self-destructive in both sense, to the Muslim community and to the
wider West.
And to the wider West. One of the most surprising things for me about your book was that you, in the end, as I read it, you can correct me if you see it differently, the biggest threat that you identify is the lack of confidence in the great British tradition.
Yes.
Rather than those Islamists are a problem, but the real threat is that people don't stand up and defend equal rights.
Spot on. And, absolutely right, Mike. And this irks me to no end that the inheritors of the liberal West are ashamed to defend that and feel as though it's colonialist and it's racist and it's sexist to stand up for a Muslim woman. I mean, there are countless examples that I met on my travels, but there was a judge in Germany that said, you know, if a Muslim woman is beaten, it's part of her culture and therefore, you know, Western law, German law shouldn't be involved in adjudicating in those kinds. I mean, that's the kind of self-hating, repudiating your own culture and heritage that creates a void that lets the far left and lets the far right of the Islamist spectrum to come together and undermine the West. And that's what we're seeing in many of our university campuses and in particular our schools and in some of the corridors of our politicians who are just afraid to say, welcome to the West, enjoy the liberties and the freedoms of the West. You have your rights, yes, but you also have responsibilities towards each other. And we focus on the rights and ignore the responsibilities.
And toward your fellow citizens who are non-Muslim as well.
Exactly, because that's our contract. That's our bond as citizens. We are not here as groups. We don't have collectivist identities, because the moment you have group identities, you know, we're one group of either our sexual identity or our ethnic identity, what you do is you create tribes against each other, yeah, who are fighting each other. And the worst thing about this, Mike, is that then groups are blamed for any act done by any member of that group. So the Muslim community is blamed for terrorism. Well, no, most Muslims condemn terrorism, but because we've front-loaded this group identity, everything is now to do with all Muslims. But in fact, it's Muslims who condemn, not just condemn, but inform the authorities of terrorism. And now the Muslims are against the gays. That's where we are, and that should not be the kind of separatism, because many Muslims are also gay. So that those group identities don't work, and they're dangerous because they focus just on rights and not on responsibilities. And you can't prosecute groups. We must not prosecute groups. We prosecute individuals. You know, and this is the danger that the group identity that is foisted on us from political elites who do not wish to accept and defend the heritage of the West for what we've achieved. And by the way, Mike, you know, I try and make this argument in the book that one of the things that the modern West has achieved, where the Romans and the Greeks failed, was gender equality.
Yeah.
You know, and we've got to celebrate that and uphold that, and not let you know, Sharia law or anything else in its literalist form undermine that.
Of course, the middle ground that you're defending, it is a middle ground you're defending. I think it doesn't naturally produce defenders. Because another group you didn't mention is you do have the far right in Britain that is actually hostile to Muslims, and if you stand up and you criticize things that are going on in British mosques, if you're from the mushy middle, but you want to defend the mushy middle, you like it there, and you think it's got things that are worth preserving. If you stand up and criticize what's happening in the mosques, you're going to get it from both sides. You're going to be identified by other people in the mushy middle as being a far right hater, but then you're also going to be accused from Muslims of being from the defenders of the political Islamic tradition and the far left for being a racist and an imperialist.
Yes, and I had that criticism. You're absolutely right. But the point is, that's the status quo.
But it's very hard. You can take it. You have a very thick skin, but the average person is going to want to just put his head down and avoid.
Yeah, but the average person feels emboldened when people come out of the political center and say both the far left and the far right are wrong and Islamists are wrong. And if we don't address it from the political center, the issues do get hijacked by the far right, as you correctly identify. And worse, we continue to make the problem worse. I think it was Aristotle who said that, as a student of Plato, that, you know, Plato, my teacher, is my friend. The truth is my friend, but the truth is a greater friend. And I try to operate in that spirit, to speak the truth, pursue the truth, because the truth has its own power of registering, you know, in the hearts that God made. And I think that's why if you speak the truth over time, whether Margaret Thatcher famously said, as you've identified, the problem standing in the center is you get traffic from both sides hitting you, knocking you over. And I can see her argument and I understand it, but I still believe that the center is the right place from which to address these issues, because that's where, to my mind at least, the truth lies.
All right. Well, on that note, let's bring this to an end. This is, I think, the beginning of a conversation about your book. We never got into any of the cities, but we'll have you back later and talk about that.
Mike, thank you again. Great to see you as always.
Thank you.
That's all we have here. Huge thank you to everyone for tuning in. Huge thank you to Mike, and a huge thank you to Hudson Institute for supporting our work. We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye. Thank you.